You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, kids today seem to be riding bikes less often than in the past. We'll look into why that is and what it means for the biking industry as a whole. Right now, it's time for our weekly check-in on news stories from around the state with reporters who are covering them. We'll find out more about the impact of Chinese tariffs on Wisconsin ginseng farmers and recap the dramatic selection of Superior's next city council president. But first, when Shopko announced in March that it was closing all of its stores, it left many Wisconsin communities with fewer jobs and one less retailer. In Wausau, the store's closing could also pose a challenge to the seniors, people with disabilities, and others who rely on the city's bus routes. Megan Stringer is the streetwise and business reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. Megan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why is the closing of Shopko a big deal for people who rely on the transit system in Wausau?
Well, this matters for people who rely on the transit system because Shopko is one of the last major discount retailers within Wausau city limits, which is where the bus goes in Wausau. There is a lot of retail in the larger metro area. It's a lot of it in Rib Mountain and Weston, where there's Walmart, Aldi, Sam's Club, Target. None of those big stores are actually in Wausau city limits. So we do have Walgreens and CVS here, but those are much more expensive than a discount retailer like Shopko.
A lot of communities have transit systems that go beyond the borders of one city. That's not always the case, though. What is it in the Wausau area that makes the buses stop effectively at the city limits?
So I talked with the transit director for the city of Wausau, and he says that they need participation from those other cities and towns to bring the bus there. So the bus did used to go to Schofield, Weston, Rothschild, and that service was discontinued in 2015 because the people that were living there choose not to subsidize it.
You talked to some folks in Wausau who have made Shopko a regular stop using the bus route. What kind of stories did you hear?
Yeah, so people love the Shopko route because it stops right at the front door in Shopko, which is great for a lot of people who take the bus who might be visually impaired or elderly. There are other stores along that route that are at larger intersections that they might have to cross. It's become a little bit more dangerous. So the Menards, the Fleet Farm are at these large intersections. If you can't see very well, it's hard to cross those places, especially in the winter and the cold, which is most of the year here, where there could be snow piles, it could be icy, and so it's dangerous for them at those intersections, unlike Shopko, which would the bus would put you right at the front door.
What kind of things did you hear from people who have counted on this about what they might do now without that option, that transit-friendly option?
Yeah, so people are still figuring it out, I think. They are planning to budget more time and more money for their errands to take the bus over to Walgreens or to CVS. But those places, it's just simply a little bit more money for basic goods like shampoo or anything that you're trying to pick up. So it doesn't seem like anybody has a solid solution right now, but I know they're working to, you know, figure out what it's going to look like for them once Shopko closes on Sunday.
Yeah, you had a story from someone, I think in her 70s, who went out to buy her mom a pair of slippers, or 90-something-year-old mom a pair of slippers,
yes.
And the only option was a cab ride?
Yeah, so she took a cab ride over to the Coles and Rib Mountain, and cab rides can be $30, upwards of $30 each way. So just to pick up a pair of slippers, a quick errand that could be $10, $15 suddenly becomes a $70 errand.
Is there concern now without Shopko there and this route to bring as many people that the transit system could have fewer riders and that could create more problems?
It is. It is a concern. Shopko is one of the big places to go on that bus route. So I know the transit director is worried about ridership. But at the same time, that route is also one of the most popular. It has more riders than any other bus route in Wausau. So I don't think they expect the route to close entirely or see any major differences, although they are going to have to figure out what the ridership looks like after Shopko closes and maybe adjust.
Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
Megan Stringer is the streetwise and business reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. She talked with us about the impact of Shopko's shutdown on people who rely on the city's transit system. Now we head to Superior, where the city council wrapped up the process of selecting their new president this week by using a random card draw. The decision caused disagreements between the mayor, city attorney, and the council, with an attempt to censure one council member for her remarks on Twitter. Shelley Nelson is a reporter for the Superior Telegram. Shelley, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Well, how did the city council and Superior get to the point where they had to draw cards to see who could be their council president?
Well, back in April, when they were supposed to reorganize and select their president, they were divided on who they wanted for the president, one city councilor or the other. They voted eight times, literally eight times, and no one ever changed a vote. And in that process, there was one councilor who consistently abstained from the vote. So they went back at it in early May. They took one vote. The councilor who had abstained in the first meeting did make his vote known, which swung the balance by one vote. And they decided, you know what, this isn't going to go anywhere. Let's move on to other business. And they adjourned the meeting and said, we'll try it again next time. And then they did it again the following meeting and came to the same conclusion. The same five councilors supported one, same five councilors supported the other, and there was one abstention, which was the abstention's purpose was to keep the mayor from breaking the tie, because councilors felt very strongly that the council body itself should be deciding its leadership, and that shouldn't be left to the mayor.
So it goes down to this card draw, and there was an argument the city attorney had to get involved to decide if it was legal to use a card draw to break the tie?
Yes. The council had requested that the city attorney develop an opinion on whether or not it was legal to do so. Back in 2009, the council had actually selected its leadership that way when the mayor declined to break the tie.
But things got heated, it sounds like, and there's some bad blood to the point where the public is getting kind of annoyed with the behavior. What kind of things were said and done that went beyond the usual civility one would hope for from a city council?
Well, one city councilor who disagreed with the attorney's opinion had posted on Twitter, and she wasn't exactly nice about it. I mean, she called it repugnantly incompetent and said the work boiled down to laziness, which prompted another city councilor to craft a censure for her. So when the council went into session this week, they decided to censure her by a 6-4 vote, but the mayor decided to use his first ever veto to override that censure because he felt it was free speech.
Now, have we ultimately had the card draw and resolved the issue of who the council president is?
Yes, we have. The one councilor, Ruth Ludwig, did not want to participate in the card draw, so she had actually asked the mayor to draw for her. Councilor Brett Fennessy drew the high card, which was a four of hearts, and the mayor drew a two of spades.
When on the four, have things calmed down now that this has happened, or does it still seem like there's bad blood, shall we?
You know, it's hard to say. The following day, 2 days after the city's assistant finance director resigned his position to take another job, the finance director, who's been there for 27 years, decided to move up her retirement date the following day. Now, she's not saying why she decided to do that, but it can't be too much of a coincidence that she did so right after this council meeting in which, you know, the public's telling the council, behave and get your stuff together and do the job of the people. And the city attorney is being abused, and the mayor's not holding a city councilor accountable while the council is attempting to do so.
Shelley, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us today.
All right.
That's Shelley Nelson, reporter for the Superior Telegram. She got us up to speed on a Superior City Council electing a new president this week, ultimately coming down to a card draw. Finally, a number of Wisconsin's agricultural exports are being affected by retaliatory tariffs from China. That includes one that's crucial to central Wisconsin, ginseng. Rob Menster is WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
We'll talk about briefly the importance of ginseng in Marathon County. I think a lot of people don't know what a big deal it is around the world.
So ginseng is certainly a unique crop. The whole economy of ginseng is basically located in Marathon County. The great majority of all ginseng in the U.S. is grown around Wausau. It's about a $30 million per year industry for the farmers. And it is also unique in that it is almost entirely the great majority of the market is in exports. So exports to China, this means that it is uniquely susceptible to economic pressure as a result of tariffs.
You attended a panel discussion on these tariffs and the impact they have. What kind of things did you hear about ginseng in particular, Rob?
Indeed. So the one thing that is just to say how much the prices have climbed as a result of tariffs. So there had been a fee on ginseng imports to China of about 8%. That's now up to over 38%, according to Will Su, who is the president of Su's Ginseng Enterprises, who spoke on this panel here in Wausau. And that is, that is causing pressure on growers. In a lot of cases, buyers just simply won't pay the price and expect the American farmers to sort of absorb a 30% loss on their crop.
Is there a fear that then China and Chinese importers will turn to other sources for ginseng around the world?
Absolutely. So Wisconsin ginseng has this reputation as the world's best ginseng. It's the top shelf stuff, and it's what the connoisseurs want. And so it already commands a premium. It is the most expensive ginseng as well in China. It's the best. But there is ginseng that comes from Canada, and there are Chinese domestic growers of ginseng. So as the price climbs, for sure, it creates a space for Canadian and Chinese growers to take that market share away.
In our last minute, Rob, what did you hear from ginseng growers in Wisconsin about how they're hoping this gets resolved?
So it is a shock to the system, and one thing that can be expected is that fewer people may continue to grow ginseng. That number is already in decline, and that decline can continue. I think that what people hope is that we'll come to an agreement, and the sort of escalating trade war will be reversed, and farmers won't face these tariffs on ginseng.
And is there a thought that this has to happen soon? I think ginseng is a crop, if I understand correctly, you got to do some advanced planning on.
Yeah, it takes several years for the ginseng root to mature. And again, like this is in the context of a long-term secular trend away from ginseng cultivation. There used to be thousands of ginseng growers here in Marathon County. That today there are 150, 180 or so. So there is a risk that this could go away, which would have a significant economic impact on this area.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Hey, thanks.
That's Rob Mentzer, WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. He was with us for a look at the impact of Chinese tariffs on ginseng and how it's impacting farmers in central Wisconsin. He wrapped up our weekly look at news stories from around the state. Here's something you might remember from when you were younger. It's summer, nice weather, you're out of school, so you hop on your bike and head to the park or to your friend's house. According to new data from the Sports and Fitness Industry Association, that's becoming less common for kids today, with fewer and fewer young people riding bicycles over the last decade. Jennifer Boldry is Director of Research at People for Bikes. That's a bicycling advocacy group that works with the bike industry. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Can you tell us how significant is the drop-off in the number of kids who are riding bikes?
You know, it's significant. We only have data back to about 2010, but if we look over all types of bike riding for kids, in 2010, about 27% of kids rode a bike at least one day a year, and in 2017, that's dropped to about 24%.
Do we have anecdotal ideas of how that might have changed by generation, or do we just not have solid enough evidence to talk about, kids back in the day?
I think we don't have solid enough evidence back beyond 2010. I mean, anecdotally, we can look at the bike racks at schools, for example, and know that, you know, when we were kids, those bike racks were full, and they're pretty empty these days all over the country.
What do we think is leading to this decline, at least since 2010, in kids riding bikes?
I think we've seen a few really significant social changes. I mean, certainly when we think about, you know, vehicle miles traveled are increasing year over year. They hit an all-time high this year. That means there are more vehicles on the road more often, and that, you know, definitely makes it more dangerous, you know, to ride, you know, within your neighborhood or within your city, that sort of thing. Other challenges include an increase in screen time for sure. You know, personal devices like cell phones and laptops and tablets make it super easy for everybody to spend all their free time on a screen. And we've seen screen time increasing. Kids are scheduled in a way that I think they maybe didn't used to be. All kinds of organized activities before school, after school. And I, you know, one of the other things, and I don't have data on this one, but you know, when we were kids, our parents would turn us out and say, you know, be home when it gets dark. And, you know, that's not as common an occurrence anymore.
I wanted to ask a little more about that safety element. Are there things we could do to design our communities better so that we're not as concerned about maybe that busy street over there or the tough crossing over there?
Absolutely, there are. And when we look for global examples, there are cities in the Netherlands and Denmark that have done exactly that. Where there's a very complete network of protected bike lanes, which means there's physical separation between the cars and the bikes, and kids of all ages are riding bikes on a regular basis. I think the bike to work mode share, and that's not kids, but it's an indicator, is over 40% in Copenhagen, Denmark, whereas in the U.S. we're at about 0.6.
What are the concerns about, okay, if kids aren't riding bikes now, if they're not in the habit of riding bikes now, what does that mean for their future healthy bike riding activity?
You know, for people for bikes, we're for sure all about bikes. But I think the real answer to that goes way beyond bikes. And that is, you know, we know that bike riding is and other kinds of physical activity are linked to positive health outcomes, you know, whereas we see increases in obesity and diabetes rates among kids. You know, that lack of activity and increase in screen time is a big piece of that. Bike riding has also been linked to positive social emotional outcomes like cohesion and links to other people, resiliency, learning to fail, those kinds of things. And there's even early evidence that bike riding might be linked to cognitive functioning and that kids that get a chance to get outside and ride bikes during the day perform better academically.
We're talking to Jennifer Boldry, Director of Research at People for Bikes, about data showing that the number of kids who are riding their bike regularly has gone down over the last decade or so. Jennifer, something that people might not immediately attach to bikes, but people in the bike industry are worried about this, tariffs on products coming in from China. How is that affecting biking?
It's a big deal. More than 80% of bike units are imported, and a big chunk of those are imported from China. The bike companies are not going to be able to reduce their operating costs in a way that can offset the additional tariff costs, and consumers will definitely see the impact of that. And kids' bikes, you know, have gotten a little bit more expensive over the years. If they get much more expensive because of these tariffs, and there's a very high probability that they will, it could really hurt kids' bike riding.
I've seen some analysis that even for products made in the United States, the cost of materials like aluminum for bikes and components of not just bikes, but bike helmets and other paraphernalia, that could be affected too?
That's exactly right.
How closely are you watching this tariff story when it comes to the availability of and affordability of bikes for kids?
We're very involved in the tariff fight right now. And in fact, Morgan Lomely, our director of public policy, was just in Washington, D.C. testifying in opposition to the tariffs. We have collected data to write exemptions for the tariffs. People for Bikes and the People for Bikes Coalition and the bike industry is working really hard against them.
Well, looking back at how to make sure kids have more opportunities for biking, you talked about some things that might work at the town or city level. Are there things at the federal level that might help make a difference?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that, you know, that are real opportunities. At the federal level, the best opportunity we would have is if bike riding were incorporated as part of the elementary school curriculum. In places like Copenhagen and Amsterdam, where we do see very high lifetime levels of bike riding, you know, kids as young as second and third grade are required to take bicycle education courses and pass a test before they can graduate that grade. And so early on, kids are socialized and in a very mandatory way, socialized to bike ride safe, and be comfortable with it.
That's at the national level. Now it's summertime here in Wisconsin. Talk, if you would, to families and maybe kids who are listening right now. How would you encourage them to get out on the bike more often?
Well, I think the number one thing is that bike riding is actually really fun. According to the Outdoor Foundation participation research, bike riding is the most popular activity among kids 6 to 17 because it's fun. And one of the things I'm most excited about is that bike parks, pump track, and bike playgrounds are starting to pop up all over the country. And those are great places for kids to go ride, have fun in a really safe environment, you know, where motor vehicles are just not an issue.
Jennifer, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Jennifer Boldry, Research Director at People for Bikes, a bicycling advocacy group that works with the bike industry. She was with us to talk about why fewer kids are riding bikes, at least over the last decade or so, and what that can mean for the future of bicycle ridership. The U.S. Supreme Court's term is wrapping up over the next few weeks. That means a number of big decisions are coming out. At least a few of them will take on thorny political issues, like whether the 2020 census can ask if a person is a citizen and how much power Congress is allowed to give the executive branch. Charlie Jacobs is Associate Professor of Judicial Process and American Politics at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Charlie, we'll spend most of our time with the U.S. Supreme Court. Wanted to check in with you briefly, though, on the state Supreme Court, this decision this morning on the lame duck legislature last December and the changes they made. Any surprises from the outcome this morning?
Not particularly. It was a little bit surprising the majority spent as much time as it did on a separation of powers issue. That is, what each institution is responsible for doing. And in this case, the court said we don't have any responsibility over supervising the types of rules and procedures that the legislature comes up with. I would say that's a little bit surprising because they're given quite a bit of autonomy and carte blanche to leave the legislature alone in creating those kinds of rules. The U.S. Supreme Court has said, you know, sometimes we might have to step in, but in this case, the state Supreme Court has said, we're going to leave that alone. It means that the state legislature is going to have some opportunities to create opportunities to do things that the court is just going to stay out of completely. That's what happened here when they had this extraordinary session under rules that they created for themselves. And so it's kind of a minor issue, but one that because of the particular partisan breakdown of the court right now, the outcome is not surprising particularly at all.
All right, let's turn to the U.S. Supreme Court now. A lot of issues. What stands out to you as maybe the biggest issue you've been watching for, whether it's one that's been the decision's been dropped or on the way out?
You know, I think that some of the cases that we're going to discuss today really are the ones that focus my attention. And it's because there are a couple that, even though they are discrete cases, really bear upon the way in which individuals are represented in the United States. One is about redistricting. One is about the census. And both of those really have to do with representation by members of Congress. Those really strike something in me, as well as the Grundy case, Grundy versus United States. And the specific issue of the case is interesting in and of itself. It's about sexual offenders registration and notification. That's the specific act. But what it has to do more than anything else is the way the bureaucracy works in the United States and maybe works in states as well. So those are some cases that we can certainly talk about and some of the specifics that are involved there.
Let's start with that Grundy case you mentioned last. It was about how exactly Congress delegates power to the executive branch. What was at stake here?
So what's at stake here is the responsibility of Congress in being specific in the laws that it writes. This is kind of an arcane issue, but one of incredible importance because Congress often will write pieces of legislation, we often say, have holes in them, kind of like Swiss cheese. You got the bulk of it, but there's some stuff that has to get filled in, and they leave that to administrative agencies like the Department of Commerce, the Department of Transportation. And this has gone on as long as the United States has been around, but we haven't had real firm rules about exactly what they can punt over to the administrative agencies. And what we're seeing with some of the newest members of the court, including Justice Gorsuch, is they are very reluctant to allow this to occur. Why is that important? It's important because if we require Congress to be incredibly specific about the laws it writes and not delegate to the agencies, it means they've got a lot more work ahead of them as Congress. And it means that there isn't a whole lot of flexibility in the way in which you can implement laws. This can have effects for things like the way in which automobiles are regulated, the way in which our environment is regulated. It will significantly reduce the power and responsibility of the executive branch and force Congress to make all the hard decisions. And since most of us know how hard it is for Congress to get anything done, it's going to make getting those things done, that nitty-gritty work, even harder to get done.
What ended up being the decision from the court?
Well, the idea of delegation of agency responsibility lives to fight another day, but there are some serious concerns from many that that's going to be gone soon. And one of the reasons is Kavanaugh did not participate in this, and there's suspicion that Kavanaugh would like to see some rejiggering of the way delegation works. And Gorsuch, who was supported by other members of the court, wrote a stinging rebuke of the majority that said this type of delegation is perfectly appropriate. I mean, this has existed since the end of the Great Depression, and much of our bureaucratic energy is in this kind of activity. If a majority of the court strips this kind of delegation away, the way in which the economy is managed, our regulation is managed at the federal level, is going to change radically, and the way in which we're regulated is going to change a lot.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College about decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court, some out, some still on the way. A lot of people paying attention to this citizenship question on the census. What is the constitutional question the justices are considering in this case?
The constitutional question has to do basically with how do we enumerate the population? That is, we're required by the Constitution to conduct a census once every 10 years. And part of that is regarding how we apportion members of the House of Representatives, those 435 members. And the question here is whether or not the Department of Commerce, which runs the census, can insert a question that asks individuals whether or not they are a citizen of the United States. Now, the Constitution requires an enumeration of the population, not just citizens. The citizenship question was used in the United States up until about 1950 and has only been used selectively since then. And the worry by some statisticians and individuals within the government is this is going to suppress the number of people who respond to the census because of a potential fear that they would have that they're going to get identified as a non-citizen and possibly ejected from the country. And so that would result in an undercount of the population. And that undercount would have all sorts of ramifications, in particular for those who are Democrats and hope to increase the number of individuals in urban areas. That's where a lot of these undocumented individuals who aren't citizens live. And so as a result, we have a fight over whether or not that question should be included. Now, one lower court said it's perfectly fine. Agency has discretion to do this. Another one said no. And so what we're dealing with here is whether or not under bureaucratic rules, this rule is appropriate. And there's a twist in this story because some evidence came out after the death of this statistician that maybe this question was inserted purposefully to help Republicans by reducing the number of potential Democratic voters who would be counted in the enumeration. So there's all sorts of intrigue going on in a very bland and dry bureaucratic matter.
Right. This information came to light after the argument had been held. So in addition to the overall question, there's also the question of, does the U.S. Supreme Court need to consider this new information before making their decision? Is this something that comes up very often?
Oh, hardly ever at all. I mean, this is one of those very rare events. And in fact, they went back In another case regarding redistricting, they went back to the lower court that said, well, we can't do anything about this until the Supreme Court resolves the original question. And so this whole thing is tied up in a number of intrigues that exist right now. So I'm not sure we're going to have a resolution of a couple of very important cases that are before the court right now.
Yeah. Speaking of gerrymandering, there are two cases that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, Maryland and North Carolina. What is at issue here?
What's at issue here? A couple of things. And in fact, it bears upon a case that the court kind of punted back to the lower courts last year involving Wisconsin's redistricting. That was the Gill v. Whitford case that was resolved last June. Two big questions. Who can bring a case regarding the drawing of district lines in states? So who's allowed to bring it? It's an arcane question about standing. Who has the power to bring a case before a court? But the other one is how are you supposed to draw these districts? Because one thing that the court has been grappling with for literally decades is, how do we as a legal body try to understand a real political question? How many Democrats or Republicans should be in any one congressional or state district? And so the court has been trying to resolve this at least since the 1990s, and these two cases bring that again to the court. Do the right people bring these cases, and what do we do if it appears like in a particular state more Democrats or Republicans are winning when they shouldn't? And so as an example, in the state of Wisconsin, the Republicans have been winning handily in state congressional districts. In 2012, they won 60 of 99 districts while only taking 48.6% of the overall vote in the state. And the question is, was that purposeful gerrymandering, that is the drawing of districts to affect a benefit for the Republicans? And the court gets so frustrated because they say, how do we measure whether there are too many Republicans or too many Democrats in a particular district? How, as a legal matter, are we supposed to know that? They're grappling with that in these two cases they've got right now.
And they're not supposed to use, when people draw lines, not supposed to use race. The Supreme Court seems to be pretty clear on that. Partisan identity is still a gray area here, but it gets weird. That same consultant on the citizenship question consulted with Republicans in a lot of states when they drew these maps, and people who are challenging some Republican-drawn maps are saying, hey, did this guy bring up issues of race and redistricting like he did with the citizenship question?
Exactly. So the same individual who has been consulting on census issues has consulted for years on these other issues related to redistricting in general. And he passed away, and sort of by accident, his daughter found a cache of files, turned them over to an organization called Common Cause, which realized how embedded he was in this process to apparently nefariously affect the outcome of all of these district lines and the elections in those states. And now they're grappling about whether or not she stole the files, whether they're appropriate to use in court. And again, these cases are in front of the Supreme Court, so nobody knows what this new evidence, what kind of effect it should have on what the court is deciding. And that's why these cases may not be resolved even in the next couple of weeks.
Charlie Jacobs is with us, Associate Professor of Judicial Process and American Politics at St. Norbert College in Napier. He's with us to break down some of the big U.S. Supreme Court cases this year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much power do you think Congress should be able to give the executive branch? That's one of the issues in one of these cases. Should regulators be allowed to fill in the details when they're implementing laws? Should Congress do more laying out of that kind of thing? What do you want to see from the U.S. Supreme Court when it comes to partisan gerrymandering, drawing district lines to try to help one party or the other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about decisions coming from the U.S. Supreme Court. Charlie Jacobs is with us from St. Norbert College in DePere, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a Supreme Court decision you've been looking at, watching for? Do you want to see the court decide on whether partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional? Should the census have a question about whether someone's a citizen or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. If I recall correctly, Supreme Courts are supposed to interpret laws, and part of that interpretation is supposed to be the intent of the legislators. How can they really interpret the intent of the legislators?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Charlie, how do they do that?
First of all, there's a dispute among justices who sit up on the high court about whether or not you are supposed to use the legislative record. Justice Scalia, who passed away a couple of years ago, was adamantly against it because his argument was a legislator could say anything during debate or a committee hearing, whether or not it's the actual meaning or interpretation of the bill that's proposed. So his argument was, I'm going to stick to the text of the statute itself and interpret that. Now, I would say most justices disagree with that because they want to glean something about what was in the minds of the legislatures. But remember, we've got 535 of those, so it's somewhat confusing to try to distill that into a single meaning. Now, how they go about this is very complicated, and there are a number of approaches to statutory interpretation and how you read the law. And while there are sort of these canons that are followed by justices, there's lots of wiggle room in there. And so it can be very difficult. And that's part of the problem with this Gundy case that we've just been chatting about, is that not only do the courts have to try to interpret it, but if you delegate responsibility to the administrative agencies, they too have to interpret it. So in many ways, this becomes sort of like some weird legal telephone game where at the end of the line, you get some massive misinterpretation of a law. We hope the justices can clarify all that, but sometimes they're as mystified as anybody else.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. We'll go to Nate in Milwaukee now. Nate, hello.
Hi, thank you. As somebody living in Wisconsin, I am concerned about the gerrymandering court case because I do think it's rigging elections. And the fight over whether or not to disclose the information as it gets discovered reminds me of some of the things that happened in Wisconsin where people were trying to hide information related to the Wisconsin court cases. In specific, I remember back in, I think it was August of 2012, when Leah Volkmer, as a state senator, had to reveal some emails that she was trying to keep on a private email account that basically included instructions on where she wanted her district lines changed to make her district less competitive, and also so that Republicans could get rid of Stas Kunis, who was a Democratic state rep representing West Dallas at the time.
Nate, thanks for the call. So the what happens behind the scenes, in this case among legislators, Charlie, does that get out to the public? And do courts consider that in making decisions?
The courts will consider that, but again, a lot of those discussions are purely partisan, and it begs that question again. Is this something that the court should try and weigh in its analysis of what's fair or unfair? And, you know, Chief Justice Roberts really gets concerned about this, because if they decide that, as an example, Wisconsin's districts are unfair, well, to whom? Democrats? Or to just sort of an average citizen, he worries that it's going to look like the court is putting the thumb on the scale to say help Democrats over Republicans or vice versa. And that's going to limit or reduce the legitimacy of the court. So that's one reason why they don't want to touch the partisan gerrymandering issue. But, you know, there are colleagues in political science that I have that have come up with these algorithms that they run through computer programs where you don't have to use partisanship at all. You can use other variables in the analysis and just create random districts, kind of like pulling the ping pong balls in a lottery game. That way, there's no chance that this kind of partisanship can infect the process. But that would be ceding a lot of power away from legislatures, and legislators don't really want to do that.
Thanks for the call, Nate. We'll bring on Bill in Arcadia now. Bill, hi.
Hi, good day. Glad to be on. My question, concern would be, hasn't this been delayed already? In terms of the gerrymandering question, and is it going to be decided finally? Is there a given date here now?
Bill, thanks for the call. You mentioned earlier, Charlie, that Wisconsin's case was semi-resolved and handed down to a different court. Is it possible that we won't have resolution in the two gerrymandering cases before the court now?
Yes, for two reasons. One, that new information that came to light regarding the consultant's work on the districts in North Carolina. And so the North Carolina and Maryland cases, many hoped, would help finally resolve the question. But at the same time, I mean, individuals thought that last year the Wisconsin case was finally going to give us some sort of answer. But because the court decided on an arcane legal issue known as standing, we didn't even get to the merits of the case. We didn't get to the question about whether or not partisan gerrymandering was even an issue. The only question they answered was the litigant who brought the case was the wrong individual and somebody else was going to have to bring the case who had actually been harmed. So, yeah, there is a large possibility that we still have absolutely no resolution about this gerrymandering issue.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College about the U.S. Supreme Court. A decision out today, Charlie, that has been in the news on a death penalty case overturning a conviction there based on how the prosecutor in this case dismissed potential jurors, a lot of African-American jurors. What did you make of that one?
It's consistent with some precedent that have been handed down since the 1980s, and the process by which you seat a jury involves excluding certain individuals because they might be biased in some way. One process is very transparent. It's called a cause challenge. So as an extreme example, if the brother of somebody who's on trial is in the jury pool, they get rejected because there's cause to do that. They would obviously be biased, but there's a secondary process. They're known as peremptory challenges. And the lawyers don't have to disclose why they are ejecting somebody from that particular jury pool, except if you can demonstrate that they're throwing somebody off the jury because they're either of a particular gender or because they are of a particular race, that has problems constitutionally. So what the court said today was, is it happened to this individual on several occasions, and because of that, he was not given a fair trial. So unsurprising, although the dissenting opinions were quite animated about their disagreement with that. And so that was kind of an interesting turn on this. But the general outcome, no, unsurprising.
30 seconds or so before we're done. Charlie, what are you seeing as far as partisan division? Some people are crossing the lines of what we think of as the conservative and liberal justices.
You know, we're going to have to wait for the data at the end of the year, but I think there have been some surprises, and I think Kavanaugh has surprised the most. He seems to have been sort of a swing justice here who has decided cases or voted in cases in ways that no one expected during his confirmation hearings. Gorsuch has been very predictable, but we're going to have to see sort of at the end of the year exactly how this all broke, because some of the most contentious cases always get resolved in June. So we're going to have to see when these final cases come out.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Judicial Process and American Politics at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He was with us today to talk about a handful of big cases the U.S. Supreme Court is deciding on, some decisions out this week, some expected probably as soon as next week. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the issue of reparations for slavery and segregation has come up in Congress and on the presidential campaign trail. Our guest tells us about the different ideas about how reparations might work and the politics surrounding the issue. The commercial radio industry has changed a lot in the last few decades, with big companies owning more and more stations over time as rules change. We'll find out why they could get even bigger in another change to federal rules. And we'll check out what looks like it'll be the biggest ever Habitat for Humanity project here in Wisconsin. It will be in Sun Prairie. We'll get the details on what's happening there. All that and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's coming up Monday here on Central Time.